This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, I'm Monty Wente-Reme. I played Icheb on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Metatrex on Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. I'm Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frueling. We're going to be talking about Star Trek IV and the issues of environmental ethics and animal rights. And Zachary, this is a rather timely topic for us, considering the recent decision by SeaWorld to cease showcasing the popular orca in their parks.
Well, Mike, it's a given that if whales are in the news, we're going to be talking Star Trek IV, so I'm glad we have a chance to squeeze this topic into our list of topics here on Metatrex.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. I recently sat down and watched Star Trek IV. I've been watching through the movies, and I got to say, this one is a particular favorite of mine. I was sophomore, junior in high school at the time when this came out, and it's probably, in terms of Star Trek movies that I've seen in the theater, this was probably one of the first that I actually went to the theater to see and didn't see on like HBO or something. So I've got fond memories of this particular episode, and I think it deals with some pretty rich subject matter considering the time in which it was written, dealing with, you know, in particular animal rights. I know we'll be talking a lot about that. I think it does bear mentioning that this particular movie did win in 1987 a Saturn Award for Best Writing. The team of Harve Bennett, Nicholas Meyer, Peter Kreitz, and Steve Mearson. So I think it was well deserved. It's a well written movie. Not always the best acted movie of the Star Trek original series movies, but the writing was fantastic, and in my opinion, Dr. McCoy has some of the best one-liners in this movie above all others.
Well, coming off the heels of Star Trek II and Star Trek III, which were really serious movies, I mean, think about it. We had the death of Spock in Star Trek II and all of this heavy drama with Khan. In Star Trek III, we have the destruction of the Enterprise. So those were pretty heavy movies. And in Star Trek IV, I think it was really important that the franchise lighten up a bit. I mean, Star Trek, the original series, Star Trek was very humorous in a way. You know, the trifecta of Spock and Bones and Captain Kirk, you know, they were a humorous group, even despite whatever issues of the day were in that series. So it was fun to see Star Trek return to kind of its humorous roots. And I think particularly brilliant is finding a way to weave in this, you know, fairly heavy-handed environmental message, which is relevant at the time. You know, the Save the Whales movement was in full swing in the late 1980s, and it was great to see just the combination of Star Trek dealing with a serious issue, but in a non-serious, humorous, lighthearted kind of way. That was just the perfect follow-up to Star Trek II and Star Trek III.
Yeah, my sentiments exactly. The way that they handled such a heavy issue, and no pun intended, when we're talking about whales, but.
Do you have exact figures for that, Mike? Mr. Scott can't give them.
If Scotty can't give them, neither can I. But it is, Zachary, it's a very heavy topic. And I think the writing team, Bennett, Myers, Kreitz, Mearson, I think they handled it in a very respectful way that I think in its own way furthered the movement. But they also gave us a very lighthearted and I think a fan favorite as far as Star Trek is concerned.
I don't think we should try to do a full review of Star Trek IV today. I think we should dive right in and start talking about this issue of whales and animal rights and environmental ethics. You know, like we said at the beginning of the show, this is coming right off the heels of an announcement, a news headline, an announcement by SeaWorld that they are going to cease breeding killer whales or orcas in captivity for the first time in quite a long time. They've been breeding orcas in captivity now for what's about 40 years, give or take there, Mike.
Yeah.
And, you know, I grew up going to see whale shows at Marine World in Vallejo, in particular Redwood City before that. It's not SeaWorld, but, you know, I have fond memories of going to these shows and really kind of bonding with the animals indirectly. You can see their consciousness. You can see their intelligence. You can see the fact that they're not just operating on stimulus response. And, you know, those whale shows did a good job of really kind of changing the perception of whales in general. I think much like Star Trek IV did. Star Trek IV really raised the perception of the potential there is inside of other creatures for consciousness and intelligence, for communication and whatnot. Even something as simple like Spock having a mind meld with a whale. You know, is that possible or is that not possible? It's a fascinating idea. What would that be like? But, you know, prior to the origin of these whale shows, you know, keeping whales in captivity, breeding them and whatnot, orcas were very much feared. They were killer whales, right? There's a reason they're called killer whales. These were creatures to be feared. These weren't cuddly creatures to be doted on. And it's really with the rise of breeding and keeping whales in captivity, combined with creating these whale entertainment shows, that the perception of these creatures started to soften up. You know, we really started to be sympathetic towards them and not fear them. So the irony in my mind here is that it's the it is those very whale shows that changed the perception. Yes. And made people friendly to the whales in the first place. And so now, you know, after all that, those 40 years of entertainment, now that our perceptions have been changed, our sentiments and our sensibilities have changed in regard to creatures like these whales. We keep calling them whales, you know, I think we'll keep doing so in the show, but technically they're orcas. But the perception that we have towards these creatures have changed in the last 40 years as a result of these shows. But now we can step back and we can say, okay, what are the real ethical issues involved now that our consciousness has been raised, now that our awareness has been raised, now that our sensibilities have changed? What is the right thing to do with these whales? So I think what we should do is spend a little bit of time talking about, you know, what are the possibilities for whales? What are the reasons for taking a non-human creature and giving it ethical consideration? You know, I think when we're talking with humans, it's very easy, right? Humans are entitled to ethical consideration. And then it's just a question of what kind of ethical theory you have. Do you go consequentialist, or do you go Kantian, or deontological ethics, or virtue ethics? You know, what is it that accounts for the way in which we should treat other people with some ethical consideration? But when it comes to non-human creatures, I think it's an even bigger open question. What is it about other kinds of creatures that entitles them to ethical consideration? I think we don't do that for all kinds of creatures.
Correct.
For bacteria, for example, we don't tend to think of bacteria as being entitled to much ethical consideration. What about the ant that I squish on my way out the front door in the morning, right? I don't think of that as being entitled to too much ethical consideration. But then you get higher and higher up the evolutionary chain, so to speak, and you get you know, higher degrees of ethical consideration. So what exactly are the properties of those animals that entitle them to ethical consideration, and what should our approach to those be? And I think it's just not obvious at all. It's a very interesting open question.
It is very interesting, but a question for you. So what you're saying is you squish ants under your shoe in the morning?
Oh, every day. I play God all the time.
Okay, well,
yeah, sure. Don't you?
Yeah. I don't think you and I can be able to do this podcast.
Well,
anymore,
right? I used to be like O'Brien. You know, he would feel bad after swatting a mosquito, but you know, after having gone through some things in life, now, you know, I'm jaded. So yeah, I see an ant, I can't help myself. No, I'm just kidding. I feel bad. I'm more like you know, young, innocent O'Brien, pre-jaded, pre-Cardassian War O'Brien. You should always feel bad when stepping on an ant.
Well, I admit that I don't worry too much about the ants. We have fire ants in Texas, and
I've
killed plenty of them. Yeah. And I suppose I'll get some hate mail because I kill ants. But
that's the caveat. If the creature's scary, you can step on it.
You can step on it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But it does raise some issues. At what point do we ascribe, certain rights and apply, you know, the same ethics that we would apply to humanity, at what point do we ascribe that and apply that to the animal world? So this is going to be an interesting conversation.
So, Mike, before we dive in and start talking about animal rights and environmental ethics as it relates to whales, why don't you go ahead and give us a quick synopsis of Star Trek IV?
Sure, Zachary. So the movie begins with Kirk and crew. They voted to accept the consequences for taking the Enterprise and going after Spock as the Klingons are arguing for extradition to answer to the High Council. A mysterious probe is en route to Earth, leaving a path of destruction in its wake. Aboard the Klingon Bird of Prey, aptly named the HMS Bounty, Admiral Kirk receives word of Earth's peril due to the transmissions of the probe. Kirk discovers that the probe's transmission is a whale song, to which no response can be made in the 23rd century, since, according to Spock, humpback whales have been extinct since the 21st century, ensuring Earth's imminent destruction. Kirk sends a message to Starfleet that they're going to intervene and launch a mission to Time Warp. They're going to slingshot around the sun, Zachary. Into the past, they're going to find two humpback whales in hopes of bringing them back to the 23rd century, where they will respond to the probe, hopefully saving Earth.
Slingshotting around the sun, not that old chestnut again.
They pulled that out of mothballs, and with some new calculations, they've managed to do it in that rust bucket, the HMS Bounty.
But seriously, before we start talking about whales, I'm kind of imagining now this rewrite of Star Trek III, where rather than mind-melding with McCoy at the end of Star Trek II, Spock mind-melds with a humpback whale. And in Star Trek III, they have to retrieve Spock's Katra from a humpback whale.
From a humpback whale.
What do you think? That's some good fan fiction right there.
That would be... I'm sure somebody's probably written that.
Yeah, that... I'm not... That's going to be our first novel together, Mike. We heard it here first. Okay, everyone. When that novel comes out, be sure to pick it up. Seriously, though, I what I love about Star Trek IV is this idea that whales have these intellectual and communicative properties that we don't realize they have. You know, previously to this change in sentiment from viewing whales as something to be afraid of, in Star Trek IV, and like I said, having to do with these whale shows that you see at places like SeaWorld and Marine World and whatnot, you know, the Star Trek IV really entertains the notion that whales are very much like us. They have consciousness, they have intentions, they have feelings, they can communicate, whether they're communicating with that space probe in Star Trek IV, whether they're communicating with Spock in a mind meld. Somehow in Star Trek IV, they manage to send radio signals to Uhura that she can detect up on the Klingon Bird of Prey. I never did understand how exactly that was supposed to work. But in any case, the idea is that whales are intelligent. And so that begs the question, well, other kinds of intelligent creatures, like humans, we ascribe moral properties to. They're entitled to moral consideration. So I was thinking, Mike, we could just kind of run down the list of different kinds of ethical theories and just see how do whales, or orcas in this case, stack up against these ways of grounding the ethical entitlement of humans. You know, whales have different kinds of properties. They're different kinds of creatures. They're not humans. So we need to talk about what exactly entitles them to that kind of moral consideration. Because Star Trek IV really does kind of take a very explicit stance on whales, right? You know, it is being not terribly subtle about the fact that other creatures besides humans are entitled to consideration in some sort of environmental sense and some sort of animal rights sense. But we need to figure out what grounds that view.
Well, and I love the journey that they take you on in this movie, because at the beginning, when Kirk first proposes this idea, there's this great banter, if you will, that goes on between Kirk and McCoy. You know, McCoy says something along the lines of, you know, you're proposing that we go back in time, find humpback whales, then bring them forward in time, drop them off, and hope the hell they tell the probe what to go do with itself. And Kirk responds and he says, you
that's
know,
the
well,
basic
that's,
idea.
That's the general idea. And he says, well, that's crazy. I love the way that they begin with this. It's a ridiculous idea. And it's ridiculous to think that these creatures are going to participate. And yet, you know, Spock is able to, through a mind meld, in many ways, put us into the minds of these two humpback whales. There's some great lines, particularly in the scene where he and Kirk go to the facility where George and Gracie are being held, and the result of the mind meld. There's some talk back and forth between Spock and Jillian Taylor, Dr. Taylor. And Spock says to Jillian, you know, they like you very much, but they're not the hell your whales, ascribing to them, you know, their own, they don't belong to her or to humanity. And she says, well, I suppose they told you that, huh? And he said, well, the hell they did.
Well, Mike, I'm glad you thought to mention that this scene in Star Trek IV, where it's expressed that this is a crazy idea, we're going to go pick, you know, go back in time, pick up these whales, and they're going to communicate with the probe and tell it what to do with itself. That's a crazy idea. And I think it's worth pointing out that it is, in the history of mankind, viewing animals as being entitled to having rights or being entitled to moral consideration would have been viewed as a crazy idea.
Sure. Right?
This is a very late 20th century, early 21st century perspective on things. And it's not the norm in the history of mankind. And of course, this is Star Trek's progressive view, right? You know, Star Trek is making this claim that we've moved beyond that sort of old-fashioned, you know, less inspired, less evolved moral perspective to the point where we can take a larger, more environmental perspective on the world around us. But that hasn't always been the case. And I think if you look back at the history of thought as it relates to animals, I mean, even if you look back at the history of philosophy, like the modern philosopher Rene Descartes thought that animals were just essentially complicated machines, that they were, you know, created by God, of course, like everything is created by God and Descartes' view, but they were essentially just you know, complicated robots. They were mechanisms that were designed to emulate certain kinds of behaviors and whatnot, but they weren't conscious in any way. So the very idea of viewing other animals as being conscious and having minds just like we are in some way, even if it's a different kind of mind in some way that we can't understand, it's kind of like that. A few episodes ago on Metatrex, we mentioned the what it's like to be a bat problem, right? That with a totally different kind of creature, with a different kind of sensory apparatus, a different kind of environment, we have no real way of knowing what the experience of being like that creature is like. But presuming it's like something and those creatures are conscious in some way, you know, it just hasn't always been the case that we've recognized that that is even possible. We tend to look at consciousness through our own human perspective. And if something doesn't have human consciousness in the history of philosophy and the history of thought about animals and animal rights and whatnot, animals have been viewed as being either not conscious at all or less conscious than humans. And that has affected our relation to them, either ethically or psychologically.
Sure. And I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe it was Descartes who ascribed different levels of consciousness to different creatures. And of course, humanity having a entirely separate level of consciousness above the animal kingdom.
Well, that kind of reminds me of this philosopher, Thomas Aquinas, in, you know, the Christian theologian and philosopher. You know, he basically had this this hierarchical view of reality that, you know, at the bottom you have inanimate objects, then you have lower life forms, then you have higher life forms, but still not humans.
Right.
Then you have humans. Then for him, because he's a theologian, it goes even higher. There's angels and then there's God, right? And there's kind of this pyramid-shaped hierarchy of God at the top and inanimate objects at the bottom and different kinds of creatures in the middle. So that hierarchical view of reality. But I think that, you know, one open question here is whether consciousness is even related to the issue of animal rights and environmental ethics, because it really kind of depends which ethical theory you have. If you're a Kantian, if you think that a being's moral consideration is tied up with the fact that it is intelligent or sentient or self-aware or autonomous, any of these properties we tend to use to describe ourselves, if that's what grounds our moral view. And that was essentially Kant's view, that we recognize our autonomy, but we look at other people and we recognize their autonomy and their self-awareness, then that's what entitles them to moral consideration, because those are the kinds of beings we can treat with respect, right? I don't treat my hand tools with respect, right? I treat other people who are conscious with respect. And that is what accounts for the difference between a moral being and a non-moral being. So now if you look at animals, you say, okay, well, if animals are conscious, the obvious thing to say is, well, they are entitled to the same kind of respect and moral consideration as other conscious beings, any conscious being, whether it's you know, humans or alien life forms or intelligent animals. It's the sentience and the self-awareness and the consciousness of those beings that grounds their ethics. But on the other hand, you know, that sounds great. On the other hand, there's a real problem in trying to know for sure that animals are conscious, right? I don't know for sure that whales are conscious. I don't know for sure that ants aren't conscious. The, you know, the ants that we were joking about stepping on earlier in the show, right? I don't know for sure that they're not. I don't know for sure that whales are. All I have is my own human perspective on the situation. So there is a real problem. If you want to try to ground moral consideration in consciousness, it seems like there's some sort of burden of proof to say before you really grant rights to another type of being, you need to really critically ask the question, how do we really know that those beings are conscious? And I think that's very difficult to prove, given that we're not whales. We're not orcas, right? I'm not George and Gracie. Yeah,
sure.
So, you know, it's just hard to know for sure it's a tenuous assumption to ground an ethical theory in as it applies to animals, I think.
Well, the fascinating thing here, Zachary, and like you, you know, I've been to SeaWorld, and I admit that I rather enjoy going and seeing the animals, learning. My daughter, who is an animal lover, we enjoyed a trip to the zoo recently. It's a great opportunity to learn conservation and learn about the animal kingdom, and I think those things raise our awareness, but there are those out there who feel that there is a moral and ethical injustice happening by keeping animals in captivity, and I certainly don't argue with many of those concerns. But the thing here is separating intelligence from consciousness. I don't think there's any question, especially when we're talking about whales and dolphins, for that matter. I think the same can be said of dolphins. We can kind of lump them in there.
Yeah, be careful what you say about Lieutenant Commander Flipper down in Cetacean Ops.
You know, there's no doubt that we're dealing with intelligence. I don't think you have to do more than see them respond and look in their eyes, and you can see intelligence. My dog, I've got a beautiful seven-year-old standard poodle. She's an incredibly intelligent animal, but intelligence is not the same as consciousness. Now, according to Star Trek IV, George and Gracie are very conscious. Spock is telling Kirk, you know, during the mind meld with the whales, that they told him that they were unhappy about the way their species had been treated by man. So they're ascribing consciousness. We're going beyond intelligence here, and they understand that an injustice is being levied against them.
I'm glad you thought to distinguish between intelligence and consciousness, because the Kantian ethical theory that I mentioned just a minute ago tends to emphasize self-awareness in the sense of, you know, a strong sense of intelligence and self-consciousness in the same kind of sense that we have an ego, right? We can take our mind's eye and turn it inwards and have some sort of self-awareness. There's a self involved in humanity. Mm-hmm. But that's different from other forms of consciousness. I'm thinking of things like the ability to feel pain, the ability to suffer, or the ability to feel pleasure on the other end of that spectrum, right? You know, that even beings that we don't normally ascribe strong intelligence to, lower life forms, seem to react in such a way that they at least exhibit the behaviors of having a sensory experience, right? They seem to experience pain. They seem to experience suffering. They seem to retreat from it. They seem to prefer things that are more pleasurable. They respond to certain types of stimuli, like if you feed them regularly and treat them nicely, they warm up to you, whatever it is. That's a different kind of experience than the experience of being conscious in some sort of self-aware, you know, psychological ego kind of way. And that's one of the other main ethical theories, right? If it's not self-awareness and intelligence that grounds our ethical treatment of a being, one other option is to try to ground that moral consideration in a being's ability to feel pain or to suffer, along the lines of utilitarian or consequentialist theories, where the goal of ethics is to try to maximize overall good consequences, maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain for the greatest number of people. You know, traditional utilitarian theories focus on people, right? Take the number of people, try to maximize pleasure and minimize pain or minimize suffering for the greatest number of people, right? But if other kinds of beings have the ability to feel pain and to feel pleasure or to suffer just like humans do, again, maybe in some sort of whale-specific way, right? Then it seems like it's an open question. Okay, when we're trying to decide what the right kinds of actions are, what are the sphere of beings that we need to take into account? Do we just take humans into account? Do we need to take other higher level mammals that have the ability to feel pain and to feel pleasure like we do in some similar way, some higher order way? And as you go farther and farther down that hierarchy of beings, it at a certain point, do we need to take into account those fire ants when we're deciding how big of a sphere to draw morally? Or do we need to count up the number of ants in the world and add that into our calculation about trying to maximize the pleasure and minimize the pain for the greatest number of beings? So the question there is, the important ethical question on that theory is not, is this being conscious or is this being self-aware, but can this being suffer? And if the answer to that question is yes, then on the utilitarian, broadly utilitarian moral theory, then that being would be entitled to moral consideration. But that's different than consciousness or intelligence.
I'm glad that you're defining some criteria here for consciousness, because I think that's important. In order for us to answer the question, are George and Gracie conscious? I think there has to be some criteria there to define what that consciousness looks like. Mm-hmm. How do we define that in terms of, as you mentioned, suffering being one of those criteria? I think there are some others as well. I think in terms of biology, where oftentimes the argument is made that there is a difference between a chemical stimulus response and an actual thought process where memory is stored and past experiences are drawn upon in order to make decisions, and it's less instinct and more a learned behavior. So I think that raises some interesting issues as well when we're talking about a criteria for consciousness.
Well, Mike, if you remember back to our previous episode of Metatrex, I believe it was called Fair Pay for Exocomps, when we were discussing mm-hmm. artificial intelligence and how do we know that machines are intelligent, right? Computers or androids or whatnot. One of the things we considered then was the Turing test, which is a hypothetical test of how you would know that an artificial being, a machine or an android or whatnot, is actually conscious or self-aware or intelligent. And in that example, the Turing test, the basic answer is communication. At least the hypothesis of that test, right? You basically have a blind test where you're communicating with this computer, probably through some sort of terminal, but now it might be through some sort of verbal communication interface if we're talking about androids or whatnot. But and then the idea goes, if you can't distinguish between a genuine human's responses and this a computer's responses in some sort of blind test where you can't see what kind of being you're talking to, then you have every reason to consider that being conscious. You'd have all the same reasons to consider that being conscious as you do a human, right? Based on your interactions. Sure. So, with humans, we tend to think each other are conscious because of our interactions, right? When I say certain kinds of things to you, you give me certain kinds of responses back that are spontaneous and they're well-reasoned. There's certain properties that they have that speak to the intelligence of you as a person. And again, we mentioned this before, like you and I have never met in person. All I can see is your face on the screen and I hear mm-hmm. your voice and whatnot. But I presume you're intelligent because of the quality of the responses that I receive when I say something to you. So now let's take that idea, this idea of a Turing test, and apply that to animals. Okay, we have two criteria in mind for grounding an ethical theory. One is maybe whales are intelligent or self-aware in a very strong self-aware, sentient kind of sense, right? They have identities just like humans have identities. I think that's one option. The other option is of course, like we mentioned, that those beings have the ability to feel pain or pleasure or to suffer, right? This utilitarian consideration. So let's look at each of those and kind of come up with this kind of a hypothetical Turing test for each of these approaches. What reasons do we have for thinking that a creature, any non-human creature, but whales in particular, are conscious? I've only been to whale shows. I know what I read in books, right? That's my experience with whales. And presumably a marine biologist, a cetacean biologist, Dr. Jillian Taylor would have a lot more to say about this than either one of us can come up with, probably. But what reason do you think we have for considering that whales are not just sensory aware, not just that they can feel pleasure or pain or suffer, but that they're intelligent, that we can communicate with them?
Well, you mentioned communication and whales famously communicate. In fact, whale songs are almost universally considered to be a beautiful form of communication, and they certainly do a great job in Star Trek IV of highlighting that fact about George and Gracie. In fact, the whole premise of the movie is this probe is transmitting a whale song, expecting a response, a communicated response. And, you know, Dr. McCoy can't, you know, can't figure out the logic in that. But nevertheless, this probe is destroying everything in its path, trying to communicate with a whale. So famously, we can ascribe communication to a whale. And if that were our only criteria, and let's just throw the pleasure and pain in there, then based on those two pieces of criteria, we can ascribe consciousness to George and Gracie.
Well, I love the way that this is handled inside Star Trek IV, because inside Star Trek IV, we don't really ever learn what the whales are communicating, right? The whales are communicating in whale song. The probe is communicating in whatever its version of whale song is. There's this communication between them. It's clear that there's communication going on, but the humans in the movie never discover what exactly the whales are saying. Now, Spock can communicate with the whales, right, in the mind meld, but that's a different thing. That's more like mind-to-mind, non-verbal, non-linguistic communication, presumably. But we never actually learn. And what's fascinating about that to me is I think whenever you ask these critical questions, like how do you know whales are really conscious? How do you know that's real communication and not mere stimulus response, right? Sure, it looks like communication. It looks like there's behavior going on that indicates intelligence. But ask that really, really hard critical question. How do you know for sure that that's not stimulus response and it's genuine intelligence? Star Trek IV seems to imply that it doesn't matter. We can recognize that there is intelligence there, and humans mm-hmm. are fundamentally unable to comprehend what the nature of that communication is. We never actually learn, but that doesn't seem to filter into the judgment about whether those beings are entitled to moral consideration. It's enough to recognize that there's communication going on, and who cares if we can't fully understand it? We don't need this Cartesian level of certainty about other creatures. We just need to recognize, hey, there's intelligence going on there. And maybe even a more tenuous claim than that. Maybe even there's the possibility of intelligence there. The mere fact that we don't know means we don't take the cold-hearted approach and say these beings must be robots like Descartes thought, right? We take the more charitable approach and say, you know, we don't know whether whales are conscious. We don't know what the whale communication means, but it sure looks like there's communication there, and we're going to err on the side of caution, and we're going to recognize that intelligence, even if it's something that we limited humans, I think Star Trek would say we limited humans, maybe, we limited humans can't understand, but that doesn't mean we ignore the signs of intelligence and take a cold-hearted approach from a moral standpoint.
Yeah, Spock would definitely say limited humans. And the fact that we don't know what they're saying, I mean, that's part of the premise of the movie. Again, the determination's made that we can't duplicate this. It would be gibberish. In fact, that was the point that Spock made. You know, we don't understand the language. Yes, we could transmit something back and probably come up with a reasonable facsimile, but the truth is it would be gibberish. Mm-hmm. Much the same way that, for instance, if I were to walk into just about any foreign country and try to speak the language, even if I knew the language to a small degree, it probably would come across as gibberish to the listener because I don't have a full grasp of the language. So they make that very clear in Star Trek IV. And hey, that's the end of the movie, and I don't mean to throw spoilers out there. Frankly, if our listeners haven't seen Star Trek IV, then shame on them. They should have seen it by now. But, you know, they able to release George and Gracie. George and Gracie hear the communication from the probe. They respond appropriately to the probe. Probe packs up and goes away.
Well, even though we're talking about two different kinds of ethical theories, we're talking about Kantian ethics, where the source of ethics is a being's intelligence or self-awareness. And then the other theory would be utilitarianism, this idea that what grounds a being's moral entitlement is its ability to feel pain or to suffer. I think, yes, those are two different ethical theories, but you can run the same kind of reasoning with that utilitarian approach, where you can say, well, what reason do I have to know for sure that a being can feel pain or can feel pleasure or can suffer? Well, it sure looks like they do, right? They have all the behaviors. You know, I think that about my cats. You think that about your pets. I think that about other people. I also think that about whales, right? It sure looks like they have all the behaviors that indicate they can feel that kind of sensory experience, even if it's not as well defined as a conscious ego in the Kantian sense. But I think Star Trek would certainly err on the side of caution, right? You know, if we have any reason at all to think that a being can feel pain or can suffer, then it should be entitled to moral consideration. But I have a kind of a deeper critical question for you, Mike, to think about. So it seems clear that we want to entitle these higher level creatures to moral consideration, whether it's in this Kantian sense or whether it's in this utilitarian sense. It seems clear in my mind whales should be entitled to some sort of moral consideration. How exactly you spell that out and which theory you rely upon, I think we could go round and round and round about that, like philosophers often do. But the danger I see is in that may not address this larger environmental perspective. So, you know, as you go farther and farther and farther down the hierarchy of types of beings, it seems less and less plausible to me that lower life forms can be entitled to moral consideration on either of those theories, right? If you just kind of go down a few levels, okay, whales, yes, they're either conscious or they can feel pain and suffer or both. So on either theory, it doesn't matter. They're entitled to moral consideration in some way. But as you go farther and farther down the chain, what about my cat, my cats or my parrot that I own, right? Which hasn't made an appearance on the podcast. One of these days, I'm going to let my parrot say something on the podcast. I'll teach it to say live long and prosper or something. I think those beings are entitled to moral consideration. I think they're either conscious, I don't know that for sure, but I've got some good reason for thinking that they are, or they can suffer and feel pleasure and pain. I've got some good reason for thinking that applies. And then as you go farther and farther and farther down the chain, I think it gets less and less plausible. What about a honeybee? What about an ant? What about a bacterium? What about a virus? Right? You know, these very lower level of life forms, it's not obvious to me at all that you can ascribe either consciousness or the ability to feel pain and suffering to any of those kinds of beings. And I think and we're just talking about the animal kingdom. If we broaden our sphere of life to other kinds of beings like plants, like do I think that a rose bush is entitled to moral consideration? Is it conscious? I don't think so. Is it can it feel pain and can it suffer? I don't think so. It doesn't have a central nervous system, all these things that seem to be necessary biologically for those kinds of properties to exist. And yet, if we look at the Earth and the biosphere as a whole, and you could broaden this, if you look at the galaxy as a whole, right, in Star Trek, you know, the different kinds of biospheres and different kinds of life forms you see on any of these planets, you know, there's some sense in which the environmental movement wants to entitle the environment itself to some sort of moral consideration. Like it's the unity of the biosphere, the coherence, the aesthetic properties of it, its intricacy, its interconnectedness, whatever, as a way of grounding this environmental movement. So if you rely too much on this idea of consciousness in either sense, whether in the Kantian sense or in this utilitarian sense, I worry that that doesn't explain the grounding that's necessary for the environmental movement as a whole, treating the biosphere as a whole because of its interconnectedness as entitled to some sort of moral consideration. But that seems like a totally different way of spelling out how you ground an environmental movement than the animal rights kind of way, which tends to focus on consciousness or the ability to suffer. You know, I think the environmental movement has an even broader sense of what grounds moral consideration than either of those views.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you should raise this point. I look at it in terms, Zachary, of a stewardship, if you will. And I see my role as a steward of the environment as a whole, not necessarily ascribing consciousness to George and Gracie or, you know, to my poodle or to the ant that you squashed under your shoe this morning as you were leaving for work, not to the plant that I killed in the backyard last fall.
You're not going to let this ant thing go, are you?
I'm not going to let the ant thing go.
Let it go, Mike. Let it go.
Let it go. But rather than look at these things as inanimate or unimportant, I see myself as a steward of that plant, that the ant, the whale, the greater environment. And I see a responsibility that I have. And certainly I think they make this point in Star Trek IV very well, because, you know, the issue is not just whether or not George and Gracie are conscious, which certainly, again, Star Trek makes an incredible point of ascribing consciousness to them, particularly in those scenes where Spock mind melds and is able to communicate, you know, their thoughts and feelings. But beyond that, you know, what is our responsibility as humanity to these creatures? So we're appalled in the 23rd century that, you know, all of a sudden we need these animals to save the world. Mm-hmm. And, well, we've hunted them to extinction in the 21st century and, you know, they no longer exist. So, you know, suddenly it becomes a problem. And I think there's some truth to that, by the way. I think there's some truth to that. I think as we, handle the environment poorly, I think as we do live our lives in ways sometimes that that hurt the animal kingdom, as we chip away at their habitats and you know, force them you know, out of nature, I think we do a harm to them, and I think the greater harm in the end comes to us as the human creature.
Well, Mike, I definitely see your point about stewardship, and I think inside the Star Trek universe, you often see Starfleet taking this stewardship approach to the universe, or the galaxy, or the universe as a whole, right? You know, mm-hmm. That's part of the reason the Prime Directive exists, right? Just let the environments, let the species, let the beings, let the races be as they are, right? Don't go interfering. Don't try to improve them. Don't change them. You know, let them be. And there's kind of this naturalistic approach to whatever world you encounter. Don't interfere with its naturalness, right? Mm-hmm. You know, its natural development, its natural properties. Don't intervene. Don't change things. You know, however you want to spell out the Prime Directive. But on the other hand, just to kind of push back a little bit, because I think that's the easy answer, right? Oh, well, yeah, we're stewards. We're going to try to protect the naturalness. You can ask this really hard, critical question. Well, what's so good about nature? We can romanticize nature. There's a whole romantic aesthetic movement, right? You can romanticize nature, you know, paint it with pastel colors and green hills and blue skies, and you know, you don't often romanticize the, you know, the lion stalking its prey, or the ant getting squished by a bigger creature, right? These aren't the romantic, lovable sides of nature. So there's a lot mm-hmm. of pain and suffering inside of nature. And you could even ask the deeper question, well, why does, I mean, I would think if you ask many environmentalists, why is nature entitled to moral consideration? What's so great about nature? They'll say, well, it's natural. And then you say, okay, well, that's kind of by definition. Nature is natural. That doesn't tell you anything, right? So what about nature in particular makes it so special? Well, it's interconnected, right? Look at the different types of species, look at the symbiotic relationships, all these things that biologists and environmentalists would want to talk about. Then you can say, well, okay, so nature is interconnected. So is the computer that I'm recording this podcast on, right? I don't think my computer is entitled to moral consideration just because it's complicated and it's interconnected. I don't think the internet is entitled to moral consideration because it's so interconnected. What's so special about the nature version of interconnectedness? And I think my concern is that as you go down this list, every time you try to come up with one of these identifying properties of nature that says, well, what's so special about it? Why is that entitled to moral consideration, and just random inanimate objects that aren't natural or man-made objects, anything that's not nature in some sort of pristine sense, that, you know, we tend to just say, yeah, that's just obvious inanimate objects. We don't think it's entitled to moral consideration. So if it's not consciousness, and it's not the ability to feel pain and suffering, and it's not interconnectedness, what is it that makes nature so special?
Well, Zachary, I don't think it's any one of those things. I think it's all of those things in chorus together that makes it so special. And I can answer that in a very self-serving way. And please don't mistake this as my answer, but I can answer that in a very self-serving way. you know, as we continue to chip away at our green space, as we limit habitats, and as creatures like the humpback whale were in the 1980s, the bald eagle, and I could go on and on and on of these incredible creatures that have at some time or another, and some of them even now on the endangered species list, as we cause to some degree the extinction of these creatures, and understand that this is not fiction. It's fact that to some degree humanity has, let's use George and Gracie. It's not a work of fiction. It is a fact that overhunting nearly caused the extinction of the humpback whale. I don't think there's anyone out there that would argue with that as being fact. So as we hunt these creatures to extinction, and please don't misunderstand, I enjoy the outdoors. I hunt. I fish. I camp, and I do those sort of things, and I enjoy them. But as we become careless with these activities, as we overhunt, and again we take away from these natural habitats, it does have a negative effect on humanity. The fact of the matter is, it is nature working together that allows us to live and breathe oxygen. Oxygen doesn't just exist naturally. There's an incredible process of actions and reactions that allow us to, you know, suck in that 21% oxygen that we're breathing.
Well, Mike, you're hitting on a key distinction that is important that we up till now haven't mentioned in the course of the conversation. When you ask the question, what makes nature so valuable? There are two broad categories of answers to that question. One answer is that nature is intrinsically valuable in some way, mm-hmm. worthwhile on its own accord, not because of its usefulness to us, right? So any of these other theories we've been talking about have tried to give an answer in that camp. If nature contains consciousness, well, then that's valuable in itself. If nature has the ability to feel pain and to suffer, if whales have that property, then that's an intrinsic value. If nature is so interconnected in some sort of aesthetic sense, and that we should take into account, that is an intrinsic value. That's not useful to us, right? And then there's the other category of answers, which is that nature is valuable because it's useful to us. Nature is sustaining to us. And even from an aesthetic sense, nature gives us pleasure. Nature gives us satisfaction. When I see the whale show, I get satisfaction out of it. When I pet my cat, I get satisfaction out of it. And that is all a very sort of human-centric perspective on ethics. And I think, you know, we do that all the time. I think there's lots of things that are valuable because they're valuable to us in a pragmatic sense. They're useful, right? You know, the biosphere sustains us, and so we attribute value to it. I don't think that's bad to do. But I think that doesn't capture the heart of the environmental movement, though, right? The environmental movement wants to err on the side of saying nature is intrinsically valuable in some way, and then this question of how exactly you spell that out. I don't think that usefulness to humans is going to be enough to justify the, you know, in some non-human, more universal sense, I don't think that's enough to justify this strong environmental movement that you see in Star Trek IV.
Oh, no, not by itself. Certainly. I just, you know, I go to the wise words of Mr. Spock. He said, to hunt a species to extinction is not logical. Zachary, it's just not logical. And Jillian Taylor says, you know, whoever said the human race was logical. And I think she's exactly right.
Well, Mike, there are a few more options to consider. I think, we've talked about this Kantian perspective that animals might be conscious. We've talked about the utilitarian perspective that animals might be able to feel pain or to suffer. We talked about this aesthetic sense, this interconnectedness of nature sense. We talked about the distinction between intrinsic value or pragmatic value, but there are other options. I think, staying in the middle ground, you mentioned trying to keep the balance of nature, right? You know, nature, mm-hmm. There's a delicacy to it, right? And we're on this tipping point right now, arguably, that if we keep pumping carbon into the atmosphere, we're going to ruin our biosphere eventually, if not now, mm-hmm. then sometime down the road. You know, so there's a balance to nature, and if you veer on either side of that, you're in danger of ruining the biosphere. And of course, people can disagree about, you know, how, you know, what factors cause that. They can disagree about the extent of it, what the long-term effects will be. There's all kinds of disagreement about those kinds of things. But if you posit that it's possible to ruin a biosphere, there's a delicate balance to maintain. The reason I mention that is that there's another category of ethical theories that we've talked about before on MetaTrek. It's called virtue ethics. And mm-hmm. the main proponent of virtue ethics was Aristotle, who thought that virtue is a matter of staying in the middle ground, finding the balance between two really opposing vices. And so, you know, nature is very much like that. If you veer too much on either side of how you relate to nature, you run the risk of ruining our biosphere. Mm-hmm. And so there is kind of this middle ground, walk the delicate balance, keep the balance of nature aspect to it that reminds me of shades of virtue ethics. So that's one other approach we could take. And I think the other is just maybe this is probably a subspecies of virtue ethics, maybe under the category of care ethics, the ethics of care. You know, we form relationships with people, so we care about them, right? You know, we care about our family, we care about our loved ones, we care about our friends. And if you think that those kinds of interpersonal relationships are entitled to moral consideration, I think you can run the same kind of reasoning to animals. The relationship between humans and animals is a relationship of care. I come to care about the whales as a result of those whale shows and as a result of watching Star Trek 4. I care about my pets because I have a relationship with them. I see relationships between animals, you know, like two lovebirds in the tree, right? Yeah. There's a relationship between those animals. And if you say, okay, well, if they're something, you know, conscious in some way like us, or you know, like us in any way, shape, or form, their ability to be conscious, and they have relationships of their own. You see this in whale pods, right? We're talking about whales. Let's talk about whale mm-hmm. pods, right?
Yes.
Whales have relationships amongst each other. You see parental relationships. You see familial relationships. You see you know, large groups of whales, super pods. I've heard the term super pods of whales, where, you know, multiple pods of whales come together into a big super pod. There's a social order to that is reminiscent of the care that humans have amongst each other. So if you take that seriously, you can say, well, maybe it's none of those things we've been talking about. Maybe the ethical consideration is tied up with this ethics of care that we see not just in humans, but everywhere in nature in some way.
I think that's an outstanding point, because I think one of the things that I find fascinating, you mentioned superpods, and one of the things that we have observed in biology with whales in superpods, one of the reasons they form these superpods is for protection. They protect one another. The way a parent would protect its calf. The way oftentimes, again, these are things that we've observed in biology and nature. When the parent is killed, how other members of the pod will take over the care of the calf. So I think that's an excellent point. You know, the ethics of care, we certainly see that in whales, and we see that in many other species in the animal kingdom.
But I think the problem is that anytime you try to prove any one of these things, it falls apart, right? I guess my concern is that you can hold philosophy to certain unreasonable standards when it comes to these kinds of things, right? I don't think we're ever going to be able to know for sure what it's like to be a whale. I don't think we're ever going to know what it's like to be a fire ant, you know, or any other creature we've talked about today. So the question is, you know, to reach any conclusions, moral conclusions about these kinds of issues, you know, the extent to which any being, whales or lower life forms, even, you know, at this really small level, bacteria and viruses and whatnot, if you hold moral judgments to the standard of certainty, I think it's going to fall apart. I think eventually, you know, the skeptical concerns are going to keep coming up. How do you really know? How do you really know? How do you really know? And you're never really going to get enough philosophical justification. But I think in this case, we're really talking about some sort of inductive argument where, look, there's just so much evidence out there. No individual piece of evidence, you know, the particular whale behavior, the particular fire ant behavior, none of that is going to be enough to conclusively prove that You know, that these beings are entitled to these kinds of considerations because they have certain kinds of properties, and we've been able to prove it. I think we can learn more. I think, you know, the history of biology has shown we can certainly keep learning more and more and more about the nature of an individual life form, the nature of the social structures of a particular species. You know, we can learn more about those things. And I guess that, you know, as we learn more, you're just kind of adding more information onto this growing mountain of evidence that that other life forms have these kinds of properties. We can't prove it with certainty. You know, I'm still going to have my skeptical concerns about whether whales are genuinely conscious, that they're self-aware in some sort of Kantian ego sense. It sure looks like animals can suffer, but I can't prove it, right? It's what's it like to be a bat problem. I just can't put myself inside another creature's mind, short of a mind meld with Spock, right? I can't do that. Maybe Spock could do it. Maybe Spock settled the issue in Star Trek IV, right? He's proved conclusively that whales are conscious because he's reached out and touched one. In an there's an AT&T commercial for you, right?
reach out and touch a whale. George.
Straight out of the 1980s.
Reach out and touch a whale.
Reach out and touch someone. Reach out and touch a whale.
Reach out and touch a whale.
Touch a cetacean. But short of being able to do that, I think these skeptical concerns are always going to come up.
Sure.
But I guess my question is what should the standard be? Should we be forced to prove these things with certainty before we grant ethical consideration to other kinds of life forms or the environment as a whole? Or do we just recognize the fact that we just keep learning more and more and more about this? We're not finding anything that contradicts it, right? All mm-hmm. we're finding is more and more evidence that shows that these beings have these kinds of properties, and that's all the more reason to entitle them to moral consideration. And then, of course, there's all these practical questions like, okay, what beings, where do you draw the line? I think I'd probably draw the line at fire ants, but, you know, short of that, I know, I'm gonna, you know, there's an entomologist group out there that's gonna firebomb my house now. I just lost all credibility with the entomologist group. So, short of that, I think,
obviously you've never seen the animated film Ants, or you would be able to describe.
Right. Yeah, they're marching on my house right now. Yeah. You know, it's, yeah, there's like a whole Borg queen out there, like Borg queen. But short of that, I think you can just say, look, you know, yeah, I can't prove it for sure, but it looks like there's an awful lot of evidence, and that's good enough. And I think Star Trek takes that perspective. You know, in Star Trek IV, we can't prove that whales are conscious. We don't know what they're saying. We err on the side of caution. We grant them moral consideration anyway, for any number of these reasons. They might be conscious. They might feel pain and suffer. They might be so interconnected. They might have, you know, relationships that are mirroring the kinds of care relationships that humans have. We can't prove it for sure, but so what? You know, we're going to recognize it anyway. And I think that's the, in light of this growing mountain of evidence that animals have these properties. Again, I think you'd be hard pressed today to find someone who actually thinks animals aren't conscious. I think 100 years ago, I think it would be the exact opposite situation, where the vast majority of people would say animals are either not conscious, or even if they are, they're not humans, and so they're not entitled to moral consideration. But I think our sensibilities have just gone a complete 180 degrees in this regard.
Yeah, I agree. We keep bringing up ants, and it's caused me to wonder what the reception of Star Trek IV would have been if instead of George and Gracie the whales, it was George and Gracie an ant. You know, we've caused the extinction of the ants, and the probe mm-hmm. is trying to find an anthill somewhere on planet Earth. It can't find one. It's
okay.
It's blowing everything up.
I'm so glad you mentioned this, because there is another option here. And another broad category of ethical theories that we haven't talked about yet, in fact, we haven't talked about it on Metatrex at all, I think, is a view called sentimentalism. Mm-hmm. And that view is that
exactly where I'm going.
The only grounding, on that view, the only grounding for our ethical judgments is the fact that it moves us in some sort of sentimental,
yes.
emotional kind of way. When I look at a koala bear, I get warm and fuzzy. When I look at a killer whale, I get warm and fuzzy. And 100 years ago, maybe people didn't get warm and fuzzy about killer whales, but they get warm and fuzzy about them now. And so it's that warm fuzziness. And you can go straight up and down the list of any action you want. Like, you know, I get warm, fuzzy feelings when I see someone helping an old lady across the street, right? That mm-hmm. that makes me feel good. It's a good society, right? And so that sentiment, that moral sense that we have, that inner moral sense, is one way of explaining our judgments. You know, you see these, you see bad actions, murder or theft or whatever, right? You go, oh, bad, that makes me feel angry, right?
Yes, we're indignant.
Yeah, there's we get indignant about it. There's an inner moral hatred for those things. And mm-hmm. there's an inner moral like them for things that make us feel good. And so you can just say, well, okay, well, whales, they make us feel good, warm and fuzzy. I see the whale shows. I smile. I laugh. I have a good time. I love the whales, right? Same thing with koala bears. Pick your favorite animal. I love my cats, right? Cats make me feel warm and fuzzy. So let's give them moral consideration. But then we have the creepy crawlies, right? We've got the ants, and we've got the viruses and the bacteria and the, I don't know, pick your favorite. Is there a particular animal that you don't particularly like much, Mike?
I don't know. I'm not crazy about snakes, Zachary.
Okay, snakes. A lot of people are like that, right? A lot of people don't like snakes. I do know a lot of people that are, they have pet snakes. They get warm, fuzzy feelings about snakes. I'm a little neutral on snakes. I think they're cute. I don't think they're particularly cuddly. I'm not interested in owning one in any way, shape, or form, but they, I don't get warm, fuzzy feelings about them. And so, you know, they're on kind of the other end of the spectrum for me. Do I think they're still entitled to some sort of moral consideration? Probably. I think they're probably conscious. They probably can suffer. So any one of these criteria we've been listing, the snakes probably meet those criteria too. But I don't get warm, fuzzy feelings about them. And I think as you go farther and farther and farther down the chain, either in terms of lower life forms or in terms of the ones that are particularly creepy, crawly, gross, right? You know, we like snails. Some people don't like snails. Some people don't like, you know, pick your favorite. It just depends on the person. I guess that's my point. The different people have different sentiments when it comes to those things, right? Most of us get warm, fuzzy feelings about these higher level life forms. A lot of us don't get warm, fuzzy feelings about these lower level life forms or the gross life forms that are out there. So we don't give them moral consideration. So I guess that's one possible way of drawing the line between these large categories of beings that are entitled to moral consideration and this other category of categories of beings that aren't entitled to moral consideration in the same kind of way, maybe in some sort of broad environmentalist kind of way, but not in the sense of an animal rights kind of way, you know. I think if you have to draw the line somewhere, if this is a line drawing problem, the sentimentalism approach might be a way of drawing the line. But it still seems a little arbitrary. It still seems a little too subjective, too based on individual preference. You know, I think in general, in an ethical theory, you want something a little more universal than that. It's not enough just to say, well, it makes me feel warm and fuzzy, therefore it must be right, or it makes me feel angry, so it must be wrong. That just strikes me as too subjective. So I'm hesitant to ground any ethical theory in that kind of approach. But with whales, I think you're right. You know, we do get warm, fuzzy feelings when we see killer whales. And that wasn't always true. It's true now. I think it accounts psychologically for the environmental movement and how it came to be applied to whales in the 1980s with Star Trek IV. But I'm not sure it's enough to ground an ethical theory in general.
Yeah, although I think I would have liked to have seen Spock mind meld with an ant. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it is fun because you can kind of just run down the list, right? What would Star Trek IV have looked like if it focused on some other kind of being? Like, I'm thinking of the snowy owls, or what was it? Right? Wasn't there an owl movement at the same time going on?
Yeah, there sure was.
What was the slogan? Wasn't there a slogan?
Well, I mean, it was the 1980s, Zachary, and again, I was a junior in high school, I think, when this particular movie came out, and we were saving everything at that point in time. I mean, you name it, there was a movement for it.
Save
it really
the rainforest,
was.
Save the, yeah.
Yeah, we were saving everything. Mm-hmm. We were saying no to drugs and saving whales and spotted owls and you name it.
Yeah. So, you know, it is fun to think about. What would Star Trek IV have been like if it had been about fire ants? Save the fire ants.
I think that would have been Star Trek the Animated Series movie.
I love it. Oh, yes, absolutely. Star Trek the Animated Series, Save the Fire Ants.
Save the Fire Ants.
We're going to have to run that by Aaron on Saturday
Aaron
morning.
Aaron and Saturday morning Trek, guys. Yep, there you go. Aaron, no charge for
we
that.
Need the 1970s perspective on this one, Aaron. What is the what would be the Star Trek take on Save the Fire Ants in the 1970s? So,
well, Zachary, we are rolling up on an hour. Any final thoughts?
Not really, other than the things we've already talked about. I think it's an important issue. I think as the modern period goes further and farther in time, as we run a greater and greater risk of ruining our environment, I think as people, you know, we run the risk of focusing on ourselves too much. As we get more inwardly focused, as we focus on our own lives and our own careers and our own, you know, human perspective worlds, there's a danger of not granting other types of beings consideration, you know, not not sympathizing with them, not trying to understand them, not giving them moral entitlement and whatnot. So I just sort of worry that as a society, it's very easy not to focus on these things. And there's a real danger that if you don't focus on them, it'll be too late one day. One day you'll wake up and there will be no more killer whales. I think one of the beings that's out, that this conversation comes up with right now is polar bears, right? There's an ongoing mm-hmm. discussion about the global warming and the reduction of the global ice sheet to the point where maybe polar bears are going to go extinct one day. You know, in our lifetimes, we might wake up to these species that do give us warm, fuzzy feelings, whether they're killer whales or polar bears. We might wake up and they might be gone. The last one will die and that will be the end of it. They'll go the mm-hmm. way of the dodo bird. And it's one of these things where, you know, you don't appreciate those things until it's too late. And so there's reason to take it seriously. I mean, it's really hard philosophically to know how exactly that works, though. Right? What is the consciousness of these other kinds of beings like? I have no idea. Right? All we can see is the behavior that these animals exhibit. What kinds of experiences do they have? Can they suffer? Sure, looks like they can. All I can see is their behaviors. I can't get in their minds. What is it about the biosphere as a whole, or the galactic biosphere, right? This interconnectedness of worlds in Star Trek universe, right? What about that makes it so special? There's an aesthetic component to it. Again, that could be read as just giving us pleasure, right? It's aesthetic. Makes me feel good to think about mm-hmm. the aesthetics of the interconnectedness. So what, right? Why does my perspective matter? So I think it's really, really hard to spell out why exactly it should matter. And philosophically, that's interesting. You do want good arguments, and you do want to try to give justification for whatever conclusions you draw. But I think oftentimes we hold these kinds of ethical theories to unreasonable standards of justification. I think, like I said before, I think there's just this growing mountain of evidence that the natural world is interconnected, and there's intelligence in it, and there's communication in it, and there's care in it. All these factors we've been talking about, it seems clear that those are part of the natural world. Any one of those would be enough to give it moral consideration on any one of these theories. So, you know, this increasingly skeptical line of reasoning, how do you really know about whales? How do you really know about polar bears? How do you really know about fire ants? I think, you know, as our sensibilities change about what kinds of beings are entitled to moral consideration, it just seems like those skeptical worries get less and less plausible, you know, the more and more we learn about the natural world. And I think, you know, philosophers might toe the line and say, well, how do you really know for sure? I'm Descartes and I think animals are robots. How do you really know, right? And philosophers like to play those kinds of mental games, but it just strikes me as not realistic. I think you'd really be hard pressed to find almost anyone who thinks that other types of beings besides humans aren't conscious in some way. Good luck trying to find one. I think even philosophers, when push comes to shove, they would just say, yeah, you know, okay, I'm a skeptic. Picture like Joe philosopher here. I'm a skeptic, and I don't think animals are conscious. But I go home and I love to pet my cat. You know, I just don't see that philosophers really act this way when they're out in the world, when they're interacting with the natural world. Most people aren't like that. I think you'd be really hard pressed to find someone who really believes that these days. And I think the growing pile of evidence we have from science and environmental studies and biology, and pick your favorite science, you know, all of them have shed light on the natural world. Psychology has shed light on the natural world. Sociology has shed light on the natural world. Any one of these disciplines would be enough to justify some sort of moral consideration. Now, as for what conclusions you can draw, I have no idea, right? It's complicated. There Sure. are practical, you know, in the real world, there are practical considerations when you have to make policy decisions or whatnot. But I think the starting point should be, look, we've moved beyond this really naive Cartesian view that animals aren't conscious and they're not entitled to moral consideration. And Star Trek IV just takes a really hard line on that and says, look, you know, whales are beings just like we are. Maybe they're even more advanced than we are. They communicate with this probe. We can't even do that, right? For all we know, they're more advanced than we are. You know, the dolphins will save
George and Gracie save the world.
George and Gracie save the world. So for all we know, I think the point is just that, look, this skepticism about animal consciousness and animal awareness and animal rights is not going to fly in today's world, and much less in the 23rd and 24th centuries. So those are my final thoughts.
Yeah, indeed. I really don't have much more to say other than what's already been said. I don't have any real conclusions either. I tend to comes short when it comes to ascribing a well-defined consciousness to an animal. Although I do believe that Star Trek IV raises some really interesting questions. And I think that's, it doesn't really give us any answers. It raises great questions. It thinks it's answering those questions for us. For instance, Spock's mind meld with the whales seems to be very definitive, at least in terms of the writing team and the their perceived consciousness of the whales. But I think beyond trying to answer the question, are these animals conscious? I think it does a great job answering the question of what's our responsibility to these animals, to the environment, and I think that's the, at least in my mind, Zachary, that's the big picture, that's the big idea, the takeaway from Star Trek IV. There's a great line, Spock says to Captain Kirk, "If we assume that these whales are ours to do with as we please, we would be as guilty as those who caused their extinction." So, in essence, he's even asking the question: is it moral, is it ethical for us to take these whales and deposit them in the 23rd century, repopulate the species, save the world? And I appreciate the fact that they ask that question, because I think sometimes Star Trek is guilty occasionally of whipping up these scenarios to serve the purpose of the story, and they don't always consider the moral and ethical implications. And here we see a very well-rounded story in which that's a consideration. And I think that's important. And when we're sitting here talking about saving the whales or saving the fire ants, whatever it is that we're trying to save out there, I think we do have to ask, you know, these greater questions and answer at least to some degree, you know, what are the implications of our actions? Because sometimes I think we have a tendency to do more harm than good. Occasionally, not always, but occasionally I think that's the case. So I think that's a greater picture in Star Trek IV, not necessarily the consciousness, but what are our moral and ethical responsibilities in terms of the environment. And Star Trek IV, I think, does a great job of painting that picture.
I'm glad you thought to mention that line of dialogue about not thinking that the whales are ours to do with as we please. And that harkens back to Kantian ethics that we started the show talking about. Remember, an important part of Kantian ethics is treating other beings, other conscious or self-aware beings, not as means to your own ends, but as ends in themselves, recognizing that those beings are autonomous. They have their own needs and desires and wants and their own free will. And, you know, if you're just going to snatch these whales up and take them, you know, into the 23rd century, that is essentially treating the whales like a tool, using it to meet your own ends without asking the whales, what do you want to do? Mm-hmm. Right? And Spock essentially is in this really, frankly, a Kantian position where he gets up there, does the mind meld with the whale, and he's the one to ask the whale, what do you really want to do? And that is incredibly Kantian, because they could have skipped that. They could have just said, we're going to snatch these whales and we're going to go and we're going to solve the problem, right? But they raised this really interesting ethical dilemma. What if the whales didn't want to go?
They did indeed.
And that would be a fascinating alternate version, maybe an alternate ending of Star Trek IV, right? What if at the end of the day, the whales didn't want to go?
And Kirk asked Spock that question, are they willing to help us?
Right. And what if the answer had been no? Wouldn't have that have been a really interesting take on Star Trek IV? I mean, what would they have done? Would they have to go back and try to find another way to blow up the probe? What do you do if the whales don't want to go? Do you think Captain Kirk would have snatched the whales anyway? I think now Kirk is a rebel. I think he might have done that anyway.
Kirk would have snatched the whales anyway and yeah, said he was exactly doing it for the greater good.
You know, like Manu was saying in our last episode of Metatrex when we were interviewing Manu Interame, you know, he was saying sometimes Captain Kirk, you know, people look at Kirk with rose-colored glasses, right? You know, he's this, you know, really ethical, nice guy, but sometimes he'll break the rules and he'll do what it takes to get the job done. He's a pragmatist. So Kirk would have snatched the whales regardless of whatever Kantian edicts it violates. But I love that they took the time to ask the question, you know, are the whales willing to help us? What do they want? Not just what do we want to do with the whales? How does it solve our problem?
Yeah.
But what's best for the whales? And that's a very Star Trek thing to do.
Oh, yeah. And just the nostalgia of this episode, Zachary. But you talk about warm and fuzzy when Scotty says, Captain or Admiral, there'll be whales here. That gets me every time.
It doesn't have the same ring if you say, Captain, there'll be fire ants here. I really want to go back and give this movie another treatment. But there are so many other interesting things about Star Trek IV. I mean, you could talk about the relationship between America and Russia at the time.
Oh, this is a great
movie.
Soviet
Union, not even Russia, the Soviet Union at the time. And, you know, there's a great many other things in Star Trek IV besides this environmental streak, the non-trivial environmental streak in Star Trek IV. But nothing we have time to talk about on this episode of Metatrek. So I hope we can revisit Star Trek IV again and give it a different treatment from a different angle. But I hope we fleshed out a lot of the different possibilities for how to think of the animal rights movement or the environmental ethics movement as it applies to whales in particular. But, you know, as you can see, this is not something that's limited to whales. You can ask these questions about any life form. You can ask these questions about the biosphere as a whole. You can ask these questions in the Star Trek universe about the galaxy as a whole, and all of them are hard to answer. So I love that Star Trek, rather than just trying to solve the problem at hand, takes the time to ask these deep ethical questions that frankly, from a storytelling standpoint, you don't have to ask, right? You could have a perfectly fine story without asking these philosophical questions. But in such a lighthearted movie like Star Trek IV, coming off the heels of Star Trek II and Star Trek III, it's amazing to me that it takes the time to ask these deep philosophical questions amidst all the comedy in Star Trek IV, amidst this problem that has to be solved in Star Trek IV. It's an incredibly rich philosophical movie, even given the overall lighthearted tone of the movie. And that's Star Trek for me.
Indeed.
Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about Star Trek IV and environmental ethics today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You've heard Chief Tripp sign on. I'm serious, Ken. Actually, out of the chair, please.
Okay. God.
I guess the Commodore has the con.
To the journey! All right, next one is from Damien Haywood. And Damien, come on. Which Voyager crew member would you hate to be stuck in the Delta Flyer with? He's always so negative. I called him on this the other day. I said, Damien, why always with the negativity? He said, at least I'm consistent. The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor. We start getting hints of Cap. We start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew, and we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
You know, visually, to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. You know, those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Trex.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other. So
he's just closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. You can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down together.
Okay. Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our handle is just @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/trekfm. While you're there, check out the Babel Conference. That's our listeners-only discussion group. It's a closed group. If you ask to join, just click the join button. We'll let you right in. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not swimming with Lieutenant Commander Flipper down in Cetacean Ops, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
You can find me around the Trek FM network. I am the associate producer for Warp 5, Trek FM's dedicated enterprise podcast. I am also in the Babel Conference quite frequently and on Facebook. On Twitter, my handle is @cmichael1701. And on Instagram, it is cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not trotting ants underfoot on your way to work, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me on several recent episodes of The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship podcast, and I'm also an associate producer on that show as well. You can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can always find me on Twitter, and my handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruehling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network, specifically C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Dennis Costello, our editor and producer.
We'd also like to recognize our new associate producer for MetaTreks, Patrick Devlin. Patrick has joined the MetaTreks team through Patreon. Patrick, we appreciate your support of MetaTreks and the Trek FM network. You can contact Patrick through Twitter. His username is MagicDrop5.
Well, everyone, thank you for listening to this episode of MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.